police. Any idea where I could find him?
Your police plan on taking me in?
I would much prefer that to the alternative.
Every leap of civilization was built off the back of slaves. Replicants are the future, but I can only make so many. I had the lock, and he has the key. I think I found him.
That's not possible. If this gets out, we've bought ourselves a war.
You're a cop. I had your job once.
Things were simpler then.
What do you want?
I want to ask you some questions. What happened?
I covered my tracks, scrambled the records.
We were being hunted.
By who?
Hello and welcome. It is bonus material time here on the Cinematologist podcast once again. I'm Darryl Linares and I'm very pleased to be joined by my good friend Neil Fox. Neil, how are you, sir?
Hello, I'm really good, thank you. It's nice to be chatting to you again.
Yep, definitely is. We were thinking very carefully about what our next little bonus material installment would be. And, you know, the discussions about what's happening in cinema at a particular moment is not often the key focus of our podcast. You know, we like to sort of do our own thing and do what we want to do at any given time. But I think over the last few weeks, I suppose the two big stories, well, first of all, was the release of Blade Runner 2049, which is the focus of today's podcast. But then also the Harvey Weinstein stuff came up, didn't it? And we are definitely very aware of that. And we were discussing whether to sort of talk about it here today. But with just the two of us, we felt that was a little bit inappropriate. And we're looking at getting a couple of female guests on to perhaps lead a discussion on sexism in the film industry in a more, you know, more developed way. And so we're going to park that for a little while and focus on Denis Villeneuve's sequel to a film that I think is very influential to a lot of people, including myself. And I don't doubt you, Neil, as well.
Yeah, no, it is a film. The original, well, not the original Blade Runner, you know, the director's cut, I would say, is a film that I have a lot of time for. That was the first version of the film that I think I saw or remember seeing, and then sort of saw the theatrical version. And it is a film that has stayed with me for a number of reasons. It's a film I still love. And watching it again, despite my decreasing kind of interest in Ridley Scott in any form, kind of went back and realised that, you know, that along with Alien, it really is an incredible piece of work, I think. And I loved watching it again in preparation to watch the Villeneuve interpretation of that world.
Yeah, I mean, I'm pretty much the same thing. I mean, I remember going through the 80s and, you know, it was 82, so I was definitely 8 years old when it came out. And I think, obviously, I must have come to it through the sort of sail-through market, which was what was called when VHS tapes, you could hire them in the 80s. That was a big thing when people started buying video VCRs for their home. And I remember sort of Blade Runner being one of those tapes that you got, and I was like, wow, this is sort of redefining what I understand cinema to be. And I think I probably changed at that moment from sort of appreciating films like Star Wars as what I understood as science fiction, and then understanding that Blade Runner was something else entirely. And the more you go back and watch it, the more it gives to you, I think. And, you know, it's definitely a case that sci-fi has been influenced post Blade Runner in terms of aesthetics and in terms of ideas. I mean, I don't think there's a science fiction film that probably doesn't have an allusion to Blade Runner somewhere in it. And, you know, I got into reading the films of Philip K. Dick, and I even wrote an article on the adaptations of his work, because there are a plenty, some good and a lot that aren't so good. So we're going to go through our thoughts on Blade Runner 2049, the film itself, and perhaps some of the discussion that has come out of it, because obviously it's a big discourse has taken place on various media. So there will be spoilers. I don't want to you know, hang back from saying exactly what I want to say. So just bear that in mind. Probably go see the film before you listen to the rest of the podcast if you haven't seen it already. So, Neil, what's your sort of overall take?
I really enjoyed it. Like, I really had a good time watching it. And I wasn't necessarily expecting to. I hadn't read any reviews. I tried to avoid too much writing about it until I'd seen it. So it kind of doesn't colour I knew kind of what some of the responses would be. And a few people that I know, their opinion had kind of drip fed in. But so I was kind of expecting to find it quite laborious and quite difficult just to endure. But I really kind of enjoyed it as a spectacle. And very similar to Dunkirk, I left the cinema with my senses heightened and changed by the visual and the sonic experience, which I loved. And I was thinking about Pacific Rim afterwards because I think that, because I think that, you know, I found it massively flawed and problematic, you know, is probably the wrong word. I think it is problematic, but I just found there were so many things that it did that I just didn't like, and I didn't think it needed to do. And I think similar to when I watched Everybody Wants Some, straight after seeing Dazed and Confused, I did this literally the night after rewatching the first film, and they're just leagues apart in terms of how they're handling material and how they're kind of creating space for the audience. I think is just worlds apart. But overall, I was just impressed by it, and I was impressed by how it felt like it's so connected to the first film aesthetically, but also a Denis Villeneuve film. Like, it seemed to really kind of showcase his interest, particularly visually and in terms of tone and a lot of things he's interested in, but shackled by the kind of the machine of Hollywood and a few missteps as well. So like Pacific Rim, that was the point, was kind of, I can see its flaws, but it didn't stop me finding it an enjoyable experience, you know. I don't know, but that's just because I don't go to the cinema as much as I used to. So, like, the actual space of the cinema, you know.
Yeah. God, I hate to. I mean, we haven't discussed what either of us think before we've come on, so we're like coming to this fresh, but that's unerringly similar to the way I felt about it, I have to say. I mean, I did think it I mean, it's always what are these films supposed to be doing? You know, it has to capture the essence of the original, but it has to try and do something with it. And I think that, you know, that's one of the things that the Star Wars reboot or sequel, whatever you want to call it, kind of failed for me in the fact that it just did overly rehash the original. Whereas this, I think, did try to expand the world that we knew. I was really worried that it was going to overly CGI that world, because I think that the key to Blade Runner is it's an analog sci-fi. You know, it's a sci-fi that's pre-digital. So if it changes it into this sort of cleaned up digital space, I think that really would have been a problem. And there's moments where I felt that did happen slightly, but on the whole, I think it did retain that sort of, you know, pre sort of cyberpunk steam and, you know, urban decay element of it. And I really like the fact that the technological updates in the film still have that sense of the technological progression is only there for some people. The rest of the people, you know, are still dealing with the crappy technology that is still there and hasn't been updated in many ways. Again, I think the sort of reverence for the original was there in terms of the neo-noir cop element, but I didn't think that, you know, that didn't quite work as well as the original, I don't think. And also, it's suffused with this kind of unrequited love story or not fully realized love story. And again, maybe we'll get onto the gender politics, because there are sort of elements of that people have spoken about. And I think, you know, Denis Villeneuve was clearly the right man to direct this film. We don't really know what the relationship with Ridley Scott will have been. I mean, one can only guess how much the studio input there has been in this. I mean, I know that you liked Arrival quite a lot. I liked Arrival, but I don't like Arrival nearly as much as films like Incendies or Enemy. I mean, if you want a kind of weird psychological surrealist movie, just go and see Enemy, because I think that's great. And like you say, the sort of aesthetics, the cinematography, as a lot of people have talked about, is absolutely wonderful. I mean, you could hack out a lot of the exposition of the film and just leave it as an immersive trip through the universe. It could work on that level. But I think the key flaw, and I think it does remind me of the flaws of reboots or sequels to Alien, not quite as bad as that, but it's a film that has to be, it can't avoid being very aware of its own importance as a film text. So it's sort of, riven with this portentousness about, you know, we have to make this sort of really significant. And I think it gets away with it for the most part because it's a film about big philosophical issues about what it means to be a human being and you know, how do we define identity in, when technology and our sense of ourselves is, we interrogate that an awful lot more today than we ever have done. So I don't know, maybe what about the length and the pacing? I mean, that's something that's been talked about. What did you make of that? Was it too long for you?
No, I mean, I thought the pacing was fine and I was a bit daunted by it being nearly 3 hours, particularly because director's cut, I mean, I'm not a big fan. I like Final Cut, but I'm not a big fan. I think it's some of the issues with this film in terms of unnecessary scenes are plague Final Cut in a way that director's cut is just so lean and so tight, 2 hours of absolutely, yeah, it's just, there's just no fat on that at all. And I didn't mind the length of this because I liked when the film allowed the space to just engage with the character in that landscape, in that world, and watch Gosling try and figure stuff out, you know, which I know is, that's when I enjoyed it more, when he was just kind of moving through the place and going from revelation to revelation and trying to put it all together. My problem was the scenes that just did that unphilosophical thing, which I think plagues the theatrical cut, the first one, which is the need to explain everything, the need to answer questions. But the problem is that it doesn't explain everything. You know, one of the biggest questions that the film poses, practically and philosophically, about, you know, the child, you know, and why that happened and how that happened is completely left unanswered, which is not a problem, but it is a problem when the film sets up to answer so many other things. It's like, why are you answering this and not this? It just seems a bit weird.
I don't think that's unanswered. I think it's dismissed because I think, and maybe it's a problem with the sort of way that the Jared Leto character, Wallace, is sort of used, because it's retroactively puts a narrative spin on the first movie that was never there. So it says, you know, so it kind of places on Terrell this thing that he created Rachel so she could have children. And he wanted that technology and he couldn't find it. And that obviously sort of places a sort of narrative spin on the first one that was never there. So, and to be honest, that did rehash a very well-worn trope, I thought, of the reason that sort of men create things and produce things and seek to dominate is because they're making up for this lack of ability to reproduce. You know what I mean? So that's been written about a lot. And I mean, it just on the pacing and length, I think the pacing is great. But like you say, I agree totally that there are scenes that just don't warrant a place in the film. And it could have been really tightened up an awful lot and still retained that sort of contemplative aura, I thought.
Yeah, I mean, I think that for me, the scenes that could have just been lost were the scenes that really highlighted the problematic gender politics.
Okay.
And just that seemed to be a misstep because they seemed to be there to show, look what we can do with our visual effects. You know, so they're both centered around Joy and, you know, the scene where she does that kind of Shawshank Redemption, discovers rain. And, you know, that was such a long, unnecessary scene where we have to see what the technology is capable of, which her did way better anyway. And then it kind of ends with this really lovely gag. And I think there was quite a few jokes in the film that just didn't land because it took so long to get to them, particularly the stuff with Harrison Ford at the end. And it's like, I don't see the point of this scene in terms of Gosling's character other than just to, you know, kind of labour a point. And then the later, obviously, the kind of, you know, the sex scene, as it were, you know, just seemed completely, because of the earlier, because all the stuff with Joy just really annoyed me. And I thought, this is just a waste of, and what, again, because in the first one, the loneliness of Deckard is so key, you know, and I thought that would have been a great parallel to this character, is if he's lonely, because it must be a lonely life. And just the idea that, you know, that we use technology to fulfill that loneliness, I think it's old hat now, you know, it's done a lot. Done better elsewhere. Something like Her deals with it, I think, much more interestingly, and just made it really kind of like difficult to watch these long scenes that were just like quite exploitative because they just didn't serve the narrative. And everything in the first, which I thought was amazing, what's amazing about Blade Runner that in the original, is that all the philosophy and technology is delivered through story and plot development. It's slow, but every time you learn something about the replicants or the ambiguity is tied to a story point. And that's when when it veered from that to just labor on stuff, that's when I found it a bit wanting. Because I was like, you can do this smarter. And obviously because it was problematic, it then just irked a bit. But again, the film, when it was moving in other directions, kind of won me back around. And the more time I spent with Gosling kind of being struggling with his own identity in so many different ways, you know, I was engaged, you know.
Yeah, no, I'm in two minds about what you just said there about that relationship between with Joy, the Ana de Armas character, because I do agree it's done much more in a much more sophisticated way in her, which, you know, I mean, the whole film is based on that kind of idea of how do we, can we sort of have a relationship with an artificial consciousness? But I think it was touching on these ideas of how we define that sense of connection. Is it real or is it unreal? And, you know, the, you know, issues around artificial intelligence and all that kind of thing. And yeah, and loneliness and sex. And I think that in a way it's funny because I think that, again, in inverted commas, the sex scene kind of works as a, kind of would work as a short film in and of itself, but I think you're right in the way that it was so definitely set up as a thing unto itself. You know what I mean? It didn't drive anything forward, and I think I agree with you on that. But I think the interesting thing for me in terms of the narrative push of the film was the way in which Kay, when he thinks he's discovered that he's the child of Rachel and Deckard, he has this purpose in life. He's kind of like given this sort of sense of, I realize who I am, you know what I mean? Or I think I realize who I am. And for somebody who, you know, is this sort of constructed being, that search for the sense of self, I think, is something that we all, you know, we're all constantly searching for, aren't we?
And I love that bit. And I love the story of the film. Like you were saying earlier, how different is it going to be? I loved the story and the journey of the, of Gosling's character. So yeah, and I thought that was really well handled and really interesting, you know.
But then when it's taken away from him, so it's taken away from him by the you know, the leader of the resistance, as it were, and she says to him something along the lines of, you know, everybody thinks that they're special, everybody thinks that they're the one. And it's that, it's really interesting existential question about, we all create this illusion that we're the center of our own universe, our center of our own story. I mean, there's a great piece in the Washington Post by Alicia Rosenberg on this, and I'll put that up on the website. But that was the key element to the story that really sort of won me over. Where are you on Jared Leto, Neil?
About a million miles away from him, if possible.
Was that bad? Yeah, I mean, it was really hammy, wasn't it?
Yeah, just, you know, I just I don't really like him as a performer. I think sometimes he's cast appropriately, but generally, yeah, just, it looked to me like a performance of someone who realised he was only on three pages of the script and tried to milk it.
Yeah,
you know, and just like, oh, and I just don't think he's very good, you know. I just uninteresting, you know. There's no ability for nuance, you know. There's no nuance, so it's like it's a flat reading, because that's all he gives is this flat one dimensional, you know. Just,
well, let me run something by you that I didn't pick up actually, or was pointed out to me by B, because I was saying exactly the same thing, and I thought that Tyrell in the first movie was a much more kind of interesting, even though he doesn't have sort of screen time, and the whole idea of the replicants seeking out their maker because they want to be given further life was obviously sort of a really revelatory part of the first film, I think, and it doesn't quite match up here. But what B said was that character of Jared Leto, you know, putting aside the performance, was actually a sort of satire of these new age entrepreneurs that we have today. So instead of like heads of big corporations who are sort of dressed in suits and ties, we've got these kind of gurus who sort of are into yoga and are into sort of new age spiritualism, but really that is a front for their ultimate aim to kind of dominate and, you know, build the world in their own image. So it's almost kind of like a satire of the sort of post Silicon Valley version of a corporate leader, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, no, and I think visually that is probably a great reading of it, you know, but I'm not sure whether his performance is in line with that. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? I think that that's at odds with the satire, which I think visually is probably, and I mean, just that scene with the, you know, the that terrible scene where the latest prototype, you know, and thinking back to Tyrell, you don't see Tyrell much in the first one, but each time it's at really key points of the narrative when the narrative moves forward in these kind of jolts, you know, Rachel and Deckard, and then obviously Roy coming back, the chess. You know, there's so many great things going on in terms of how they're delivering what Tyrell's really engaged with. I just couldn't understand what he was saying a lot of the time. Like, just not, I could understand the words, but I was like, what are you, I don't know what you mean. And then that, you know, kind of the kiss, and I was just like, oh, this is not good. And just an odd decision, really, you know, because I think that the cast was very good, you know, and he just kind of stands out. Well, yeah, apart from Ford, which we might talk about as well,
Yeah.
In terms of his.
Well, I mean, yeah. What did you make of that? I mean, I just see him now doing a kind of, you know, I'm going to turn up as my older self in these movies and kind of have that moment where I come out of the shadows and it's Harrison Ford and that's it. It's almost the film, I think, almost could have been better. It would never have been made like this because, if you know, they always would have got him back. But if he was some sort of ghostly presence who never actually was there, and the sort of fight scene between him and Gosling was completely pointless again, apart from the aesthetic value that it gave, because they set it obviously in that sort of nightclub bar thing that gave you the little nostalgia feel. I mean, again, that's one of the big criticisms, isn't it? That the narrative points were setting up the ability to be aesthetically interesting. And yeah. I mean, I know you as a screenwriter would prefer it to be the other way around all the time.
Yeah, I mean, I don't mind the digressions from the plot, but they have to be at least philosophically interesting, or kind of create a tension in what you're seeing that is surprising. And it just felt like, oh yeah, this is the fight scene, you know, and just the scene where right at the very end where the car is kind of sinking to the water and he's kind of trapped in. And I just thought, wow, are those the best two takes you got? Which is literally him just sat there. Like, Ford makes no... He's not even acting. He's just waiting. And I was just like, that to me as a filmmaker just suggests that the best two takes they got was him where he just sat there. And it's not kind of sad, like his character is resigned to it. It's just like, it looks like an actor who can't be bothered to act while tied to a chair. And there was a lot of that, which is, I'm not bothered. I can't be bothered to do anything. And it's like, yeah, why are you here, you know? And I think that scene, you know, and the scene with Gosling in the casino, is you can see Gosling's working really hard. You know, he's working really hard to try and engage him.
Oh, yeah, yeah. To be honest with you, I think Gosling is very good.
Yeah, I think he's very good. And he's trying to get something. And Ford's just not, he just refuses to give it to him.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
You know, and I'm just like, it's so weird. Like, it's odd. But yeah, so there's lots of things like that you just think. And I think, again, it's how much can Villeneuve, you know, what can he do? Like, Deckard is Blade Runner, like it's, and the story is always building towards that. It's kind of inevitable. You know, would have been almost like great kind of have some kind of Coen brothers touch where the whole film spent searching for someone, you get there just after they've died or something, which would have been funny.
Not to go into a sob story, but when I went and watched this, I was really not feeling well. I had the cold and I was tired. It was like, you know, and then it was 3 hours long, you know, nearly. So in the sort of latter half of the film, when they went back and you sort of discover that Anna Staline, this doctor, this sort of dream creator for the memories, is the child, I kind of lost the connecting point how we got there. Do you know what I mean? It was like, I felt that wasn't, I mean, we're sort of criticizing the idea that this is over-explained. And then when you, and maybe it was in certain senses, but then when you do explain stuff, it's got to work, hasn't it? You know what I mean? I mean, did you feel the same at all? Or were you kind of, did that work okay for you? Maybe I was just losing it at that point.
Yeah, no, I think that one worked okay for me. Because I think the thing is that was one of the scenes that I remembered. And the whole memory thing I thought was really well handled. You know, I didn't particularly like her having to build a birthday party while explaining it. That, you know, but the whole concept I thought was great. And then, yeah, one of the rare moments of ambiguity where she's kind of saying that this happened to someone, and he instantly thinks it's him. And I thought, oh, that, I didn't necessarily think it was her, but I was like, okay, that he's doing that thing of kind of assuming it's about him, and which is kind of natural, I think. I really like that bit. But I think that there are other things as well, like you're saying, with the, because some of it's explained and some of it's not, and how it's explained is kind of different. It's difficult to keep track as you're watching, you know, and I only saw it Monday, so it's kind of still fresh. But I think it was quite difficult to think, how does this connect? But not necessarily enough to make me want to directly kind of rush back to see it, you know, because, like, I just wanted to kind of sit with it a bit more. Do you know what I mean? So...
Yeah, I know. I do want to see it again for sure. And we're going to go back and have another look, because I think maybe there are things that do work, but I just didn't catch them at the time, because it was fascinating. Me and B watched Magnolia the other night, which is even longer. But just honestly, that is a masterpiece of a film. I'm sorry. No, sorry to digress, but the 3 hour running time just clips like that. So maybe this will work again over time in sort of solidifying itself as a great piece of work, because people, you know, get more chances to see it and sort of realize how things are connecting up.
And I think, and as maybe, well, you know, there's nothing to say that in 10 years' time there's not going to be a director's cut which cuts out all the exposition, which is exactly what happened the first time round. A lot of the stuff seemed to be kind of labored because the 10 studios or whoever was involved in making it felt like they, you know, everything needed to be explained. And it's like, oh, so no one learned the lessons of the first one. at all.
The other thing I'm kind of worried about, and again, B explained this to me, thankfully, there is a possibility that they've left open a whole bloody franchise.
Yeah, no, I think it's absolutely been left open for a franchise, because you can't make anything now that isn't.
No. The whole sort of replicants versus aliens, you know, war is on the cards, isn't it? And you just
Ridley Scott's kind of rubbing his hands in glee, I think, at the potential for H.R. Geiger to meet Vangelis.
Yeah, no, but I mean, it would be lovely, wouldn't it, if they just left it 30 years and then made a new made another one when Ryan was a bit older and long in the tooth. You know what I mean?
Absolutely,
I could deal with that. You know?
Yeah, totally. I guess we should kind of just touch on the gender politics of it, you know, in terms of, because I think it's a good example of a film that we like a lot. We have problems with different elements of it, and that's obviously something that is so, it's been the main talking point.
Yeah, I mean, when I came out, I had this reaction that I have with quite a lot of films, which is the film misogynist? Does it actually embody that, or does it simply represent a world which is misogynist and patriarchal? And I think you could read it in either way. You know what I mean? I think that the people who would naturally sort of say, well, there are no female characters there are representations of female characters that simply reproduce dominant problematic stereotypes. And I think that's the case. But again, would a dystopian future that comes out of the 1982 Blade Runner world have solved patriarchal representations? It wouldn't have. So if suddenly everything was kind of perfectly rendered and equal in that sense, then it wouldn't ring true in terms of, you know, this is a dystopian fiction going forward. And I think that, you know, it is problematic in terms of the you know, the character of Joy does enact that role of subservience. But I think kind of like she kind of has to, I think, you know what I mean, in a way. I do think that the character of Love is quite underdeveloped. I mean, I think it's greatly portrayed by the actress and is an interesting character. But in a sense, she's just sort of like a henchwoman for Wallace and doesn't have that sense of autonomy that all replicants seem to be searching for. But then on the other hand, I think that the film is interesting and quite progressive in terms of the idea that the central character in terms of this child is a woman, and Ryan Gosling just sort of assumes it's him, of course, does that male thing where, well, of course I am the center of this story, but it turns out that's not the case. So there's something kind of interesting going on there. So I don't know. I don't think that there is. I would be inclined to sort of push back against the idea that, oh, this is just another misogynistic rendering that panders to a kind of male gaze aesthetic. I think it's doing more than that.
Yeah, it's because as I was sort of mentioned earlier, I knew there were rumblings of, you know, issues of race and gender in it, and I think the race one is kind of glaring. I think that is, you know, just because, like, you know, there's Lenny James, and I think the problem is that this idea that the first one does really well is obviously that off-world colonies being developed, and there's, you know, there are the levels of society and where we are. You know, the poor are mostly ethnic poor, you know, for want of a, that's probably a horrible phrase, but do you know what I mean? And then in this one, they're not there. But we know that everybody's left the planet who's got money. So where are the, that felt a bit more glaring. The gender thing, I struggled to see how bad it was. Do you know what I mean? I did think, well, maybe, no, and I started to read some stuff, and Beth and I read some stuff about it, because I was interested to see, like, because I just thought, well, okay, I'm watching this as a white man, and I think I'm pretty, you know, pretty progressive about it. But I saw a lot of women in it, and what I saw were poorly written characters. And then, of course, that's the realization, is that it comes down to agency. And Beth sort of said, what's depressing as a woman is to see that not only that things are so bad still, but that no one can imagine how women might behave in the future to make it better. You know, and I think that the problem that the film has is a kind of naivety. You know, Villeneuve's talked about, well, there's loads of female characters in it, yeah, but there are a lot, and none of them are given any kind of real dimension because there's so many of them, so they end up being stereotypes almost by default. So an intention to have a world populated with a diverse range of female characters hasn't quite worked, because, like you say, in theory they're good and interesting, but what they're given to do is so limited because they're trying to fill the screen time. So, yeah, I'm not sure it's... I think it's a shame, you know, and I think that, yeah, I could imagine being a female audience member and thinking, oh, this is our lot still, you know, and that the ideas of what we might be capable of or how we might address the patriarchal problems are so narrow. But I didn't feel like it was, I felt like it was well-intentioned. And I think that I could see the point he was trying to make. I'm not sure whether he worked hard enough to work through how to portray it, but I certainly didn't feel like it was, yeah, misogynistic or ignorant of women. I just thought it was maybe naive in terms of, you know, imagining a world. And then I think you do look at the writers and the directors and you think, actually, yeah, how many conversations did you have that could have been solved very quickly about how you're, do you know what I mean? I think that's something that seems to be missing, is men thinking they're doing a good job and thinking that they can add to the conversation without really knowing how and what might make it better or more interesting. And I think that's, to me, what it's highlighted is a need in those big films and those big franchises, particularly, or those, it's just who's having those conversations and how are those representations being discussed in terms of getting them on screen? Because I'm sure there was other ways to do it, but yeah, I was again, yeah, kind of impressed. And and also because there was so much of it going on, it was a shame that that moment with Gosling where he kind of misinterprets his fate is just kind of lost as a plot point where it's so powerful. And like you say, it's like it's just another man thinking that they are the saviors of the world. And it would have been, again, I think hopefully that'll kind of come out in the future in terms of how the film is viewed, because I think it's very smart in many, many ways.
It just reminds you that when you're watching something, you bring yourself to the text. Do you know what I mean? You're sort of bringing your perceptions all the time. And as you just said, we sort of try to see that, you know, to see that point of view when we're watching stuff, you know, particularly, you know, with, you know, some people might say we go on about it a bit too much on the podcast, but you know, it clearly those elements of how gender is represented is a key conversation that is going on and has to be at the forefront of the way that we're thinking when we're talking about filmmakings. And it's interesting because you've got obviously you've got two male leads, you've got a male director, you've got a male producer, and you've got a male cinematographer, and it's
two male writers as well.
Two male writers, of course, and it's riffing off a very, you know, a very male orientated story. And one could argue a very male-orientated genre. So does it do enough to kind of show its sort of level of sophistication about its awareness of you know, some might say, why does it have to? And well, it kind of has to, because all films are ideological on some level. You can't kind of get around that. And I think it's great, actually, that we are having these conversations now. I mean, I think it's one of the fascinating things about engaging with contemporary cinema and contemporary representation, whatever the medium, that you have to have that self-reflexive element whenever you're coming to something and thinking about what is it telling us ideologically? Well, how is it presenting a worldview and how can we question that worldview? And if you just sort of say, oh, well, I'm just going to ignore that and everything is just aesthetics, as I've stopped listening to Bret Easton Ellis, because that, you know, it's just like, well, no, we have to park all of that. How is this as just a pure piece of art? And on a pure piece of art level, you know, yeah, I definitely enjoyed it, and with the reservations that you've highlighted. But some of those things that come out of it in terms of representation, I think are interesting and worth talking about.
Yeah, and I think you're right there. I mean, that you sort of mentioned the two of the big kind of stories of the last few weeks in film have been Weinstein and this, and they are kind of connected in many ways, particularly in the sense of the talking about it and the awareness of it. And, you know, there was an interesting podcast where they talked a bit about Weinstein, and then it was like, you know, from a publication which has since landed itself in quite hot water over the internet, but it was like, oh, can we just talk about the films now? And it's like, hey, hang on a minute. Do you know what I mean? Like, and again, you know, this is, you know, that kind of dismissive, and not talking about it and not grappling with it as well is why we're in the situation we're in terms of the type of content that we're watching, and, you know, an industry which is still dominated by men thinking that they can do it, because so quickly it moves from, well, let's not talk about the representation because it's just a sci-fi movie, or let's not talk about it once because there's other, and it's like, no, let's talk about it. And I, for one, think that if people don't want to listen to us talking about it, they just want to talk about the movies as movies, then that's kind of not what we want to do with the podcast, because I think that, and not what we want to do as people, you know, we don't engage with the world in that way. And I think now is the time to definitely not slam Villeneuve and Blade Runner, but to talk openly and kind of critically about what it's trying to do well, what it's got wrong, and hopefully kind of raise those issues so that the next one is more aware, I guess.
Mm. Just sort of to finish off, really, I mean, it's interesting, just a couple of things I've been reading this morning about the box office of it. And, you know, there's another article in Wired I was sort of perusing, which was talking about the laziness or some unsophistication of audiences today. And I think it's not... That kind of, I think, misses the point, because here is a film that is trying to do two things. It's trying to retain a sort of cult, cool status of the original, which had that philosophical depth and a kind of ethereal, contemplative aesthetic, but then place it into a blockbuster market that is used to this exposition, action set piece, exposition cycle, you know? And it's very difficult to place that. To me, it's done as good a job as it probably could have done, notwithstanding some of the comments that you've made and I've made in terms of structural problems and then other things that they were always going to have to do, but maybe it was always going to be a problem, you know, like Harrison Ford.
Yeah, exactly. But then also, like, you know, the original Blade Runner didn't do very well critically or at the box office, and that was at a time when apparently movies were the best they've ever been and audiences were flocking to see Raging Bull and flocking to see Heaven's, you know. It's like, hang on a minute, like, you know, there is a real misty-eyed kind of ignorance of... But I saw it on a Monday night in Falmouth with a big audience and they liked it. You know, that was a big, you know, what you might call it, you know, regular audience. A week or so after, apparently it's tanked and no one's going to watch it. And I'm like, hang on, I was expecting there to be no one there. And it was full. And not only was it full, that they came out and they were actually kind of, there was an atmosphere of, what have we just seen? You know, like wanting to talk about it, you know, which I think, again, it's just because there's so much on the first weekend, it just any kind of nuanced conversation is out the window. But that's why we're here, Daria.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's the great thing, isn't it? It about the film, I think. It does leave you with that moment afterwards where, what have I just seen? And that's great. When you walk out, you think, oh, I know exactly what I've seen, and it's crap. That's terrible. It's like, you know, not knowing really whether how to think about this, but wanting to think through it at least. And, you know, that's great, because it could have been a nightmare, couldn't it, really?
Absolutely, yeah. And again, yeah, kind of realizing there's so much to talk about, not all of it positive, but still really loving the experience. I think that's kind of rare. So yeah, definitely worth kind of delving into.
Lovely. Well, I think that'll just about do it. Thanks for tuning into this bonus episode. We have a full episode coming soon, hopefully. So Neil's going to be in charge of that one.
Yeah, next week we are screening Elaine May's A New Leaf.
Fantastic. So we'll look forward to speaking about that. And good to see you, Neil.
You too.
Yeah, and thanks to our audience. We will catch up with you very soon on the Cinematologist podcast. Thanks for listening. It's on board.